On March 8th and 9th, 2010, Cleveland Right to Life launched the first annual Bringing America Back to Life symposium and exhibition dedicated to the entire spectrum of issues that make up our journey to pave the way to a full understanding of the sanctity of life in our culture. Through prayer, action, voting, and education, we will pave the way to achieve this goal. We know you will be edified and encouraged as you listen to our roster of 12 fine speakers who, with their thoughtful, lively, expert presentations, eloquently defend the right to life.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation this afternoon. The purpose of me being here and defining is from the perspective of so many people wanting to know about the Mother Teresa of Calcutta, which she taught me, as far as finding inner peace and happiness in life, the purpose of life, as well as reverencing the dignity of the unborn. My story goes back to 1992. I was practicing interventional cardiology at that time, and I heard that Mother Teresa had had a heart attack in La Jolla, California, wanting to meet her and having a very important question in mind that I needed answered from her. I called the homeless shelter in Tijuana, Mexico, and asked if she had been recuperating there. And they said, yes, she was recuperating, but she was not taking any visitors because she was very weak and very tired. And being the selfish person that I was at the time, I told them, please tell Mother that there's somebody who's suffering a great deal. He's in a lot of pain, and he desperately needs some spiritual guidance. And knowing that Mother Teresa would never deny anybody who said that they were suffering, they said, okay, you can come, but stay only 5 minutes, okay? Please ask only one question because she is very weak. So the next day, I canceled my office, and I jumped on a plane here from Cleveland, flew to San Diego. And a couple hours later, after renting a car, I was on the west side of Tijuana, Mexico. They took me into a little room, probably about the size of half of the stage, with a table, little wooden table, and two old wooden chairs. I sat there, and they allowed Mother Teresa to come in. She was very tired and weak. If there's any physicians or cardiologists in the room, you know when somebody's impending congestive heart failure, you look at their neck veins, and you see jugular venous distension. Her JVDs were about 4 or 6 centimeters, and I could realize that she was impending congestive heart failure, mildly diaphoretic and very weak. But yet it was very humbling to realize a woman who was this sick was willing to see somebody she didn't know. She said she was not one to spend a great deal of time chattering, like where are you from or what do you do, how much money do you make, what's your future plans. She wasn't one to ask those types of questions. She was very succinct and got right to the point, and she said, why have you come? I said, well, I've come for 3 reasons. Number one, I've never been in the presence of a perfect human being. I've never experienced the presence of a person who is totally self-giving and a human representation of agape. And I just want to stare into your eyes, which she thought was a very strange question or request. But she stared, and her eyes are grayish green, by the way. And then I said, I've never felt the touch of perfect humanity. I've never felt the hands or received the blessing of a perfect human being. And she reached her hands over and grabbed my face and gave me a blessing. She said, but the sisters told me you have a question that you need answered and you needed my help. I said, yes. I said, Mother, I used to be happier in my medical practice, but right now I find myself lost. I'm hemorrhaging my happiness. If I was hemorrhaging blood as a physician, I'd go to the emergency room and have it sutured, but I'm hemorrhaging my inner peace. I feel like I have no sense of happiness and inner peace. And last year I thought maybe to resolve this, all I needed to do was make some more money and get a couple more titles. So I made more money and acquired a couple more titles, and now I'm even less happy. I'm less at peace than before, and I'm very depressed. I think I'm spiritually bankrupt. I'm confused to a point where I'm not even sure why I'm here. Not here in Tijuana. I'm just not sure why I'm a doctor. I'm not even sure why I'm a human being. What does it mean to be human? So the question I have for you, if you can't answer this question, fine. I'll go home because I've just been the thrill of my life to have met you. But the question I want to answer is I want you to tell me what Jesus Christ is going to say to me and ask me at the moment of my death. When I close my eyes for the last time, I want you to tell me what Christ is going to say and what he's going to ask. Because if I know what he's going to tell me, and if I know what he's going to ask me, then I'll have a firm understanding of the purpose of life. Because if you know how you're going to be judged, then you'll understand your purpose or consequences of what it means to be human. What are your responsibilities of human beings? Now, for the young people in the room, I'm going to present this as I would to our pre-med students at Notre Dame University in bioethics and medical ethics. So now you're going to hear a little bit of a lecture, a presentation of what it's like to be for a half an hour student at Notre Dame University Department of Ethics and Theology. And I said, is that too difficult of a question to answer? She said, no, that question is very simple to answer. And I said, thank God, because it's been very, very confusing to me. I am just lost. And I'm not a stupid person. I had to admit it. You know, you feel like you went to college for 4 years, you went to medical school 4 years, you did an internship, 3 years of internal medicine fellowship, 2 years of cardiology fellowship. You know, I did all this training. I have all this academic wisdom, knowledge, but I feel very, very unwise of how to understand human purpose. I feel very uneducated and lost to how to find sustainable inner peace and happiness. Can you tell me the purpose of life, how I'll be judged, and how I can acquire a sense of inner peace and happiness that can be sustained? She said, yes. She said, Jesus said in only one place in the Bible. And by the way, this is kind of like a journey we're taking up a hill right now, because the purpose of protecting the unborn child will become very clarified in about 15 minutes to you. But I have to give you this background. She said, there's only one place in the Bible, she said, Jesus describes judgment. There's a lot of discussion about sin and about being saintly and being good, but there's not a great deal of discussion about judgment. But in Matthew 25, Jesus is asked, how will you judge us? And she said, do you know Matthew 25? I said, I was ashamed to tell her I went to Notre Dame University. I wasn't that familiar with it. But she said, I said, no, and I reached for a Bible that was next to her. She said, no, don't read it. Let me tell you what he said. Now, after I had a meeting, this initial meeting with her, I went outside and wrote down everything she said very clearly. So I'm going to tell you exactly what she told me. I'm not going to tell you she said something like this or she meant something like this, because I think it's critically important these words come in exactly as she gave them to me. She said, Jesus said, when you die or at the end of the world, he's going to come back in his glory, surrounded by angels, and he will separate all of us, all people, all nations, into two parts. Just as in the old days, the shepherd would separate the sheep from the goats. And on the right, Jesus will say, you shall enter the kingdom of glory. Because I was hungry, you fed me. I was naked, you clothed me. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was sick, you tended to me. I was small, I was tiny, I was frail. I couldn't speak for myself. And I had no way of protecting myself. And you protected me. And those that are chosen will say, we're so glad we've been chosen, but Jesus, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or naked? When did we see you helpless? And Jesus will say, and she reached across the table, which really surprised me, and she grabbed my hand and lifted up my hand. And she said, Jesus will say, whatever you did for the least of these, the marginalized, the poorest of the poor, the weakest of the weak. And she touched each one of my fingers, which she would do very, very often, by the way. And she said, you did it to me. You did it to me, she told me. She said, you see, Jesus comes in the distressing disguise of the poor, the homeless, the weak, the lepers, the AIDS patients, the unborn child. He comes as the poorest of the poor, the weakest of the weak, and asks us to love him. Jesus comes and says he asks us to love him and self-give to serve him. He asks us to be compassionate. You'll be judged on how compassionate you were. You'll be judged on how much you gave yourself out to serve others, to serve humanity and God within that humanity. You must be compassionate. Now, for the young people in the room, you have to be very, very careful when you talk to someone whose intelligence is far superior to yours. When you have a mystic or you have a spiritually empowered person like Mother Teresa and you're talking to her, that you define terms very carefully. So I interrupted her. I said, excuse me, but please define compassion, because I want to be sure I understand exactly what she's telling me. What is compassion? And she said, compassion is nothing more than the desire to alleviate the suffering of another human being, to love that person. I said, well, then please, because my 5 minutes are way over. I mean, I was 15 minutes into this, and I was sweating like I had my best suit on. I had a gray suit and gray tie, my new gray shoes. Think that was, she would care about that. It was ridiculous. It's 110 degrees in the shade, and I had my best shirt and tie on. I was sweating and profusely anxious. And I said, well, then what is love? You tell me to love people. You know, I don't even know what love is, because I have to have you define love. Define love to me. She said in the Bible was written in ancient Greek, and there are three terms for love for young people. There's three kinds of love. There's eros, which is sexual love, physical love. There's philia, ancient Greek term, like we get the word Philadelphia. Philia, Philadelphia is a city of friendship. Why is it a city of friendship? Because philia is a form of love, meaning of friendship love. And then there's the special love, she said, and that's agape. That's a love a mother has for a newborn child. That's a self-giving love with no consideration of self. This is how you have to give yourself out and grow in agapic love. That's the greatest of love. Consequently, the conversation went on, and she explained why. Oh, thank you. Thank you. And then she told me, to complete the initial meeting, she said, Jesus will look on his right and say, you shall not enter kingdom of glory. Because I was hungry, you didn't feed me. I was thirsty, you gave me no food or drink. I was helpless. I was marginalized. I was sick. I had no way of communicating or protecting myself. You did not protect me. I was an unborn child. You did nothing to save me. And they will say, well, but Lord, if we knew that was you, we didn't know that homeless man, that leper, that sick individual had no insurance or no money, who couldn't pay your fee as a physician. If we knew that was you, and that's the point of, doesn't matter. Because when you denied the least of these, that was me, you denied me. That kind of ended our conversation for the day. It took about 40 minutes. Sisters came in and asked me to please. That was enough, because she was tired. I was embarrassed and felt very guilty that I'd done that. But instead of staying 3 hours where she was, I actually stayed 3 weeks. In fact, my wife and my daughter called the FBI in San Diego and had them actually literally send federalists to Tijuana in Mexico to see if I was kidnapped. I was calling them back every day saying, there's something here so breathtakingly beautiful, such wisdom, such an understanding of the purpose of life and how to acquire and sustain inner peace and happiness. I just want to remain a part of this for a while. So consequently, the relationship developed over a period of 5 years to a point where I was honored to be one of her cardiologists and one of her physicians, but I didn't cure her. She cured me. I gave her a few pills. But she educated me. It's interesting to note, too, that sometimes higher academic knowledge or degrees or titles are inversely relationship to the amount of wisdom or knowledge a person has. I had some higher degrees of intellectual knowledge, but I lacked the wisdom of the purpose of life and how to find sustainable peace and happiness. There were pearls of wisdom that she gave me. And I think it's important to mention now, a Right to Life organization is not a social organization. The Right to Life organization, as defined by the story I told you, is a spiritual organization. It's a trip. It's a course. It's an organization that, if you're a part of it, you are in a structure that can lead you to salvation, because it's structured in such a fashion that it's geared to focus on the poorest of the poor, those who are least able to protect themselves. Even a leper or a homeless individual, a person with AIDS, has some ability to beg and express and communicate. The unborn child has none of these. The unborn child is truly the poorest of the poor. So being a part of such an organization is truly a spiritual existence in its most pristine and profound state. Interesting story, not to become too intense here. I one day asked her, "Mother, how can I be a better physician?" Because in Calcutta, if you really know Mother Teresa, you spent some time with her in India. She was around all the time. You had an opportunity to sit down with her sometimes and talk to her. So how could I become a better physician? And now, if a pre-med student at Notre Dame came up to me and said, "Dr. Wright, how can I become a better physician?" I would have to teach a course a whole semester to that student to tell him how to become a better physician. Her genius was that she answered that question to me in one sentence. Brilliant people, people who have an insight that are far beyond, that transcend our basic academic intellectual experience, can sum up things in a couple words. How can I become a better physician? And she said, "Well, Dr. Paul, don't ever forget who you're touching. Don't ever forget who you're touching." I think that's a good mantra for all of us. You're touching humanity. You're touching Christ within that humanity. As long as you understand what you're dealing with, then you'll be a very, very great physician, because you'll reverence the dignity of life. That was her major concern in teaching people, was reverencing the dignity of life, womb to tomb. One day, she asked me, because she had a sense of humor also. She called me, she said, "Dr. Paul, I have a question for you. How much do you pray during the day?" Now, I knew her well enough that she had a sense of humor that it was a trick question. Because whenever she'd come up to you and she'd, "Dr. Paul, I have a question for you," I knew she was going to try to trick me. So she said, "How much do you pray?" And I knew over time that these are questions now that I've got to be careful. I said, "You mean at night or during the day?" She said, "During the day." I said, "You mean on Sunday or like Monday through Friday?" She said, "During the day, during Monday through Friday." So while I'm practicing medicine? "Yes, while you're practicing medicine." "I don't." She said, "Well, what do you do then?" And I said, well, then I thought to myself, I better impress and emphasize to her how busy I am so I don't have time to pray. I said, "Well, in the morning I do six heart catheterizations." Now that's, mother, when you stick a needle in somebody, you put a catheter up to the heart. She said, "Oh, I know. I've had a few of those. What else do you do?" I said, "Well, I rush to the hospital and emergency rooms. In an emergency room, I go to hospital and make rounds, and I come back and make office visits. I don't have time to pray." She said, "Well, then you don't know how to pray." I said, "Teach me how." She said, "The next time you go into a patient's room," you can extrapolate this to your own profession, whether you're a housewife or lawyer or whatever. "Next time you go into a patient's room, I want you to forget about yourself completely. I want you to think only of that patient's welfare. I want you to go into that room thinking only of alleviating that person's suffering, mentally and physically and spiritually. To go into that room, think about self-giving only to that patient with no consideration of self." She said, "That's what we call praying the work. That's praying the work." You see, she said, your whole day can be a prayer. Your whole life and existence can be a prayer, as long as you're motivated of getting up, alleviating and protecting others, especially those who are vulnerable, who do not have the ability to protect themselves. Interesting stories. You're talking about in Calcutta, you talk about modification of healthcare processes. Humorous story. I'll give you, we can take a 2-minute break and find a little humor. First time I went out to Calcutta, I asked Mother, where do you want me to go? She said, I want you to go to leprosy colonies. By the way, there's 6 million lepers in India. Leprosy is not something that has been eradicated from the face of the earth. There's 9 million lepers in Africa. I was in Haiti developing a medical clinic for the sisters, and I was going through a hospital called San Croix. San Croix Hospital is in Léogan, Haiti, about 22 kilometers west of Port-au-Prince. And they were showing me malaria patients. And I said, that lady has leprosy. And they said, no, she has malaria. I said, well, she has malaria and leprosy too. That's a leper. So we have leprosy even just 150 miles from our borders. But she said, I want you to go to leprosy colonies. I said, Mother, I'm a heart specialist. She said, I know. I said, I don't know anything about leprosy. She said, well, it's not hard because all you have to do is give them pills. There's, you know, leprosy, and it's true. Leprosy can be made non-contagious for 2 months of double drug therapy. And then for 2 more years, it's triple drug therapy, and there's a cure of the bacillus. But she said, I don't want you to go to leprosy colonies to cure leprosy. In India, we are Hindus, and they believe in a caste system. And if you have a leprosy, if you're a leper, then you cannot hold a public office. You cannot marry. And in small communities, you have to go to a leprosy colony to live. So if a young woman who's 14 or 15 years old, let's say, one day looks at her skin in the mirror and sees a fawn-colored discoloration, and that's leprosy, your parents will discharge you from your home. You cannot live in your home anymore as a young woman. You cannot get a job. You cannot marry. You go to a leprosy colony and live with strangers. She said, I want you to go and tell the lepers that we have that leprosy is disease, because in a Hindu faith, they believe that of reincarnation, if you have leprosy, it's a punishment by God from sins you have committed in a previous life. And I want you to tell them that they've been abandoned by their family and their country, but God has not abandoned them. God still loves them. And this is a disease. So she always wanted people to know that she loved them. But again, she had a preference to lepers because they are marginalized and poor to the poor. Well, interesting story, and the humorous story I want to tell you about, talking to young people about quality of care, is I went into leprosarium and they were amputating fingers and toes because it's poor perfusion of extremities and nose and ears. You lose these areas first with leprosy. And the person doing the surgery was suturing up. And anytime a surgeon walks into a room with another surgeon doing surgery, it's only customary to say, may I follow suture for you? Now, following suture is when a surgeon puts a stitch in and pulls, you know, you sew, you put a stitch in, you pull up the string. Well, the surgeon following suture grabs a string and holds it taut so another suture can go in. And the guy's dripping ether. Now, the older folks here in the room, when we got our tonsils out, you remember, we had ether, okay? With ether, you apply ether. If a person is applying ether, the person's respirations will start diminishing. The respiration stops, the person dies. So they stop breathing or slow down the breathing, you have to stop dripping the ether. And this guy had the mental retention of a ferret on crystal meth. He was dripping this ether and looking around the room at flies, not paying any attention to the patient. So I asked the surgeon, where did you get your training? He said, well, I'm not a real doctor. He said, Dr. T came here a couple months ago and taught me how to amputate. I'm just one of the priests of the Missionaries of Charity. And I said, well, how about the anesthesiologist? Where did he get his training? He said, he pulls my rickshaw. So it gives you some quality of how grateful, by the way, you should be that you're born in America and you have the quality of care that you do have. With a prescription for inner peace and happiness, the number one obligation that she taught me is, number one, is reverence and the dignity of life, womb to tomb. One cannot acquire an ability to have a sustainable inner peace and happiness unless you understand purpose. You're focusing on serving your purpose. Now, that doesn't mean you have to be a doctor or a lawyer, or you can be a housewife, just as functional. But you have to understand, by the lesson Mother Teresa taught me, that we're all called to serve. We all have to serve humanity and God within humanity. How we choose to do that's between us and God. You may want to be an engineer. You may want to be just a beautiful housewife and serve humanity in that respect. In fact, I just made a beautiful friend who's Latino and today. And in Latin America, one of the most prestigious positions one can have is a mother, a housewife. Because you take a physical examination and you say, what do you do? And they'll say, ama de la casa, corazón de la casa. I'm the heart of the house. I'm a corazón de la casa. I'm the mother. I'm the center of the house. I'm ama de la casa. I'm the love of the house. The house centers around me. The most important unit of my life centers on me. That's my grandparents, my husband, my children, my grandchildren. So you can all serve, but understand you're called to serve humanity and God within that humanity. How you do that is between you and God. I've been chosen, I think, to become a cardiologist and serve in that respect. But sometimes purposes change and directions change and callings change. But there are, by observing her over the 5 years I was there, if you want to obtain a sense of sustainable inner peace and happiness, I've extrapolated from what she taught me and how she made decisions that there are 10 spiritual attitudes. And the first of those is referencing the dignity of life. The second was humility. Being grateful also and thankful for God-given gifts. Learning how to forgive. Just a piece of advice for our young people. Forgive your parents. Forgive your brothers and sisters. Forgive your teachers. Forgive your the athletes you work with. Because nothing can pull you further from a sustainable order, peace, and happiness than hating and being consistently angry. Do it for yourself in humility. As you young people grow and acquire positions and title, understand that humility can really self-destruct. Huge is faith. And I want to tell you something about her faith. Also respect to the unborn. But by observing her, I'll tell you her faith in a story. About 3 months after I had met her, I got a phone call at my office. And Annie and Kathy were there. They got a phone call and said, rang my bell and said, there's somebody on the telephone that says they're Mother Teresa. It's probably from the office in Warner or somebody. But, you know, we know you were down there. Do you want to take this? I said, well, yes. I had the phone. Sure enough, it's Mother Teresa on the phone. So I said, no, it's Mother Teresa. Oh, my God. So everybody ran to all the phones and picked up the phones and extended. Oh, listen to her voice. She stuck to Paul. I have a problem. I'm back here in Tijuana. And I want to develop a medical clinic. And anybody who's been in Latin America knows the cheapest forms of transportation is the bus. Poor people ride the bus. They don't ride taxi cabs. They don't have their own cars. So she wanted this piece of land next to the bus terminal in Tijuana, Mexico, because she says if sick people get really ill, they can stay on the bus for a peso, and they can get to the medical clinic next to the bus terminal. First, she asked for the bus terminal, which is like four stories high and held about 300 buses. They told her, you can't have that, but maybe we can get you the land. Well, they found out the people who owned the land lived in Mexico City, and they weren't going to give it away. They weren't going to sell it. So we were there day three, and I was getting very anxious. And I said, Mother, we're not going to get this land. She said, you know, Dr. Paul, you worry too much. She said, you should pray more. So she told all the people there, I mean, literally thousands of people by this time kind of knew she was there, pray for my intentions for this land. So they now in Mexico, not like the United States, if you're behind on your federal income tax, they'll give you a chance to burn it off. In Mexico, you have two options. Either give your money to the government or give your money to the government and go to jail. That's your two options. So they found out these people were behind in income tax. They gave the money to the diocese. The diocese gave the land to Mother Teresa, and she got her property. She didn't know exactly how it happened, but that's the way it happened. She did not worry about the consequences of her decisions. This is a critical point. She lived by divine providence. She never worried about her decisions. Well, me, if I have a problem, I look at the problem and I'd say, now, what response can I give to this problem to be sure the results are exactly the way I want them to be? Because this is what I want. I got a problem. So how can I manipulate? How can I communicate to get these results? And no. She would look at the problem. She would pray on the problem. And she would say, is this God's work? And I would say, Mother, it's God, definitely God's work. She said, if God wants the work, he'll provide the resources. Because she said, God doesn't go bankrupt. God doesn't make mistakes. So our responsibility is to do God's work, make decisions for Jesus. If it's not for Jesus, it's not worth doing. She said, make that decision. She said, I made my decision. I said, well, how do you know how this is going to end up? She said, that's in God's hands. It's not my problem. I've made the right decision. The consequences I'll accept in peace because these are in God's hands. Because God doesn't make mistakes. Because God wants to work, he'll provide the resources. This is living by divine providence. And this is a form that goes a long way to give you a sense of inner peace and sustainable inner peace and happiness.
We hope you enjoyed this Bringing America Back to Life Symposium presentation brought to you by Cleveland Right to Life. Please encourage others to listen to this and the other 11 presentations. We hope you will join us next year in our nationwide effort to bring America back to life. For information about our symposium or for more information about our full set of audio and video products, call 216-661-3000 or visit our website at clevelandrighttolife.org.